White supremacy isn't just about extremist groups or overt racism. It's the water we all swim in. This ideology constructs whiteness as superior and grants unearned privileges to those who possess it, persisting despite legal advances because deeply held beliefs operate at unconscious levels. Though race is scientifically proven to be a social construct, with only about 0.01% of genes reflected in external appearance, these constructs create very real consequences. The work begins with recognition, not self-flagellation. White privilege doesn't mean your life hasn't been difficult. It means your skin color hasn't been one of those difficulties. As Peggy McIntosh described, it functions as an invisible package of unearned assets that includes everything from media representation to not having to educate your children about racism for their physical safety. Understanding white supremacy as a system rather than individual acts of meanness allows us to move beyond defensiveness toward meaningful action. Why do racial discussions trigger such intense reactions? When confronted with conversations about race, many white people respond with anger, defensiveness, tears, or silence. Robin DiAngelo terms this white fragility, a state where even minimal racial stress becomes intolerable, triggering protective moves to restore comfort. This fragility undermines allyship. When BIPOC share experiences of racism, fragile responses include minimizing, "That doesn't sound so bad," dismissing, "You're imagining it," or defending, "Not all white people." These reactions prioritize white comfort over BIPOC experiences and create additional emotional labor. Examples include a spiritual coach demanding, "What about black supremacy?" when called out, or white tears in professional settings leading to HR complaints against BIPOC colleagues. The solution is building stamina for racial discomfort, sitting with uncomfortable emotions without expecting BIPOC to manage those feelings. When fragility arises, notice it, name it, and choose a response that centers learning rather than defending. Have you ever stayed quiet during a racist joke or avoided race conversations due to discomfort? This white silence, the complicit quiet of people with white privilege regarding race, functions as a form of violence that actively protects the status quo. Breaking white silence risks relationships, professional standing, and community acceptance. Yet the collective cost of maintaining silence is immeasurably higher. When white people choose comfort over speaking truth about racism, they reinforce systems that dehumanize BIPOC communities. As Desmond Tutu noted, "If you are neutral in situations of injustice, you have chosen the side of the oppressor." Breaking white silence requires sustained effort beyond occasional social media posts. It demands speaking up when it matters most, especially around other white people, intervening when witnessing microaggressions, addressing systemic racism in professional settings, and amplifying BIPOC voices. Ultimately, white silence costs BIPOC communities their safety, opportunities, dignity, and sometimes their lives. Anti-blackness is a distinct form of racism rooted in the dehumanization that justified chattel slavery and its aftermath. Black women face misogynoir, the intersection of racism and sexism coined by Moya Bailey. They're either superhumanized as strong or dehumanized as unworthy of care given to white women. This manifests in real consequences, like the maternal health crisis, where black women are 3-4 times more likely to die from pregnancy-related causes. Black men confront stereotypes portraying them as unintelligent and sexually aggressive, narratives persisting from early films to modern racial profiling. They're either feared or fetishized, treated with suspicion, as when two black men were arrested at Starbucks simply for waiting, or cast as magical Negroes, existing only to serve white protagonists. Most disturbing is how anti-blackness affects children. Studies show black boys are perceived as older and more likely guilty than white peers from age 10, while black girls are viewed as less innocent and more adult-like. This adultification denies black children their childhood, treating them as adults rather than children deserving protection. Have you ever wanted to be an ally, but weren't sure if your actions were truly helpful? Many well-intentioned people with white privilege inadvertently reinforce white supremacy. White saviorism stems from the belief that BIPOC are inherently inferior and need saving. This appears when volunteers travel to Global South countries with passion but little cultural understanding, when white teachers rescue students of color, or when nonprofits help marginalized communities without empowering them. Tokenism uses BIPOC as props for apparent diversity without meaningful inclusion. It manifests as brand tokenism, visual diversity without policy changes, storytelling tokenism, underdeveloped BIPOC characters, emotional labor tokenism, burdening BIPOC with all race-related discussions, and relational tokenism. I can't be racist because my partner, friends are BIPOC. Optical allyship is surface-level activism that platforms the ally without challenging power systems, like social media activism without real-world action. True allyship isn't an identity, but an active, consistent, and challenging practice of working in solidarity with marginalized groups and transferring the benefits of your privilege to those who lack it. When someone points out problematic behavior, our bodies react physically. Increased heart rate, shallow breathing, muscle tension, with white fragility intensifying these responses during racial conversations. Unlike accidentally stepping on someone's foot, where we immediately apologize, white people often derail racism conversations by focusing on intentions rather than impact. Common problematic reactions include defensiveness, crying, which centers white emotions, tone policing, claiming colorblindness, tokenizing BIPOC, and inadequate listening. Making mistakes is inevitable in anti-racism work. What matters is responding with humility. When called out, pause and breathe. Remember that the person addressing you is taking a significant risk, having likely faced hostility when discussing racism before. Being called out is ultimately a gift. It represents someone believing you're capable of growth despite past disappointments with white responses to feedback. As Ijoma Oluo notes, the beauty of anti-racism is that you don't have to pretend to be free of racism to be anti-racist. Anti-racism is the commitment to fight racism wherever you find it, including in yourself. Awareness without action perpetuates white supremacy. After recognizing complicity, create concrete commitments with accountability measures, addressing white fragility, using your voice, supporting BIPOC, contributing financially, and continuing education. Personal relationships offer powerful leverage points for dismantling white supremacy. Many excuse family racism to keep peace or dismiss elders' prejudice as from another time. Parents especially must discuss race with children beyond platitudes like, "We don't see color." The goal isn't perfection, but persistence, continuing difficult conversations, modeling accountability when you make mistakes, and demonstrating that anti-racism is a lifelong commitment. As Toni Morrison said, "If you are free, you need to free somebody else. If you have power, then your job is to empower somebody else." Becoming a good ancestor means considering how today's actions will impact future generations. While white supremacy didn't begin with you and won't end with you, you can contribute to its dismantling. This work isn't about comfort, but committing to uncomfortable growth. As James Baldwin wrote, "Not everything that is faced can be changed, but nothing can be changed until it is faced."